I have to admit that I would rather work than do anything else, which, I mean, that's a great thing to be able to say. It's a little strange from most people's perspective. So I love it, but then I also, I also feel, terrified. I spend a lot of time worrying about whether what I've done is any good or interesting or worthwhile, or is it the best thing I could have done? Perhaps I should have slept even less. Who knows?
This is The Conversation. It's episode 202 with Ellen Harvey. She is a Brooklyn-based artist. Yes, another trip to Brooklyn. She's working on all sorts of projects, including public ones, including a massive mural for the Miami Beach Convention Center. So if you are going to be heading to Miami Basel, not this December, but the following December, you will get to see her piece there. Or perhaps you are going to be attending in September of 2018 the AHIMA, American Health Information Management Association Annual Convention, or in October of 2018, the 24th Congress of ISAPS, International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgery. So if you're attending any three of those events, you will get to see Ellen's massive mural at the Miami Beach Convention Center. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is still theconversationpod.com, where you will see Ellen and some of her assistants working on that mural, the early stages. You will see images of various other projects of hers, as well as the side of her loft building where she has been since the 90s. Good time to get in. Not as good as the 80s, but still a good time to get into Williamsburg real estate. And you also hear about a quite surprising prior career that she had before becoming a full-time artist. Surprised me. I think it'll surprise you as well. So stay tuned for that. Great to talk to Ellen. She has a charming British accent, which we talk about because she did not grow up entirely in the UK. I challenge you not to be charmed, not only by the accent, but even by what she has to say beyond the accent. It feels like it's been a long couple of weeks, doesn't it, since we last spoke? Or I last spoke, if you prefer. So let's go ahead and launch into that conversation. On the back end, I'm going to give you an update on the second podcast that I've been working on. I will tell you about that on the back end. In the meantime, let's get into the conversation. And thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you more on the back end. So you are, so speaking of working and you know, your studio, what is the setup? So first of all, you're in Williamsburg. You're in the north side of Williamsburg, right?
I am, yes.
Yeah, which is my old neighborhood, at least that's where my studio was many years ago, on 11th and Berry. I believe you're right around the corner from there.
I'm just on, my building is between Berry and Wythe on North 10th.
Okay, yeah, just a block away then. And is your home and your studio intertwined, or what's the setup?
Yeah, I have a loft that's a live workspace, and I've been here for almost 20 years. And then I got incredibly lucky. I mean, I don't own anything, but it got covered by the loft law because it was sort of an illegal living situation. And as a result, when my building got sold, my new landlord couldn't throw me out. So
wow.
Yes, I'm like a dinosaur, kind of washed up on the shores of Williamsburg, with the few artists I still know here. But I tell people that how long I've lived here, they laugh, and I say I came here because it was so quiet and cheap, and then they fall over laughing.
Right.
More.
Yeah, and that's partially because the artists that still do live and work in Williamsburg. I mean, this is obviously, this is a generality because there are artists in your neighborhood, but the most artists who are still in Williamsburg are like in the eastern part, right? Generally?
Well, most younger artists are sort of more out in Bushwick and Bed-Stuy,
sure,
or Ridgewood. People have moved further out.
Yeah.
And artists who are here, either they bought, they were in a position to buy at some point, or they were covered by the loft law. So Yeah.
And how, how long are you covered by the, how long a lease do you have, or how does it work?
It's indefinite.
Wow.
So I can never move. I'm just going to become older and,
right.
and be surrounded by more and more beautiful young party people.
And so how much irony is in that particular comment? How much satire?
Well, I like parties. So, you know, I didn't move to New York to be living in a kind of quiet isolation.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
So I'm good with it.
What kind of party are you, Ellen?
Oh, I'm definitely a dance party. What other kind of party is there?
Okay. I was wondering what kind of partier you are. Are you a, do you like to drink a lot? You know, do you like to be really extroverted? All of the above?
I mainly just like to dance.
Wow. Okay. And are you, do you have a husband or a significant other that you dance with, or do you like to dance with strangers, or how does that work?
It's all good as far as I'm concerned. There's
right.
the pleasures of familiarity, and mm-hmm. then the well-documented pleasures of strangeness, and they're all good.
Uh-huh. Okay. So to go back to maybe we'll pick this stream up a little later when you've got loosened up a bit. But to go back to the loft situation, it reminds me of a law in that I think is more trenchant in Manhattan, which you may be familiar with. I think it's called I might need your help actually with this. It's some kind of not a maintenance fee, but a some kind of payment that you make to your landlord or the landlord company when you have a loft. That one example I heard was it was like $35,000, but this was years ago. But basically, you get to hold on to your lease, which in cases like that is a very low rent. Does that sound familiar?
You might be thinking about fixture fees.
Fixture fee.
Where you,
sure,
you
that's
buy,
it.
You buy the contents of the loft, like the renovations from the previous tenant.
Yeah.
So you compensate the previous tenant for their, and then you sort of, there's a lot of tedious minutiae about the whole thing, but the great thing is that it means that you end up becoming a kind of rent-stabilized tenant, which in New York, especially if you have the fortune or the misfortune to be in a sort of rapidly gentrifying neighborhood, is you know, obviously fabulous.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a segue to your situation is similar, but you didn't have to pay the fixture fee. I mean, you have a fixed lease, correct?
Yeah, no. The fixture fee you pay to the previous tenant,
so you did.
The landlord. So I did. Yeah. So there was another artist who lived in this loft before me. At which point I was living in the basement of this building.
Ah.
And then she moved out, and then later I took over her lease and I paid her a fixture fee. And then the loft law got passed, and then I, as the person living in the loft, you know, got covered by the loft law, which was very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're in, you know, this, for New York, this really central and teeming location. And just to warn you, we may not get off of this topic for a while, so we'll see what happens.
Oh, no.
So brace yourself.
Okay, I consider me mentally braced.
Okay, good. No, if you need to bail out at some point, just wave the white flag. No, I just want to know, I mean, this is something that I ask. You can't not ask this of people who are living in the fancy part of Williamsburg, and that is, what has it been like to see this, you know, extreme, one of the more extreme examples of gentrification over the last 20 years that you've been there? I mean, is it everything under the sun from thrilling to depressing, or is it, how would you put it?
I think you can't see, it's not a one-dimensional experience.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I mean, it's weird because obviously I'm not from here. So, but I have lived here since the 90s and the late 90s. And I did move here because it was quiet and all my artist friends were here and you could get lots of space for nothing. And I took over my friend Eve Sussman's loft, which was, 4,000 square feet, which is kind of crazy.
Wow.
And I don't live in something as large as that now. But there are things that are great about it. I mean, I don't miss being mugged. I don't miss not ever being able to get a cab to cross the Williamsburg Bridge, which now just seems so ludicrous, but it used to be impossible. But on the other hand, it was also kind of lovely and quiet and intimate, and there weren't very many restaurants. And when you left town, you could leave your key in the restaurant so your friends could use your loft. You know, the mm-hmm. things that are definitely not the case anymore. It's just, everything has got a lot fancier, and there are good things about that and bad things. And you see people, there's a huge difference between people in the neighborhood who live in rent stabilized situations or who own, and people who don't have all been displaced.
Yeah.
And that includes not just, artists I know, but also obviously the people who were there before the artists, which was largely, Polish to the north and Hispanic to the south.
Mm-hmm.
And so the character of the neighborhood has changed massively. And sometimes it's confusing. You walk down a block and you think, wait, I don't even remember what was here. It's three blocks from my house and it looks totally different.
Right.
I can't remember what was here.
Yeah.
It's like moving without having moved. That's how I feel. And my whole building got sold, and then it became a luxury rental building. And there have been great things about it. Like, I have a doorbell for the first time, and I don't have to leave a stick in the door downstairs. And I have an elevator that you can actually call. And, I mean, these are all massive improvements to my quality of life. So that was great. And yet at the same time, now I don't know anyone in my building.
Yeah.
Except for the other people who are covered by the loft law. It's not that kind of building anymore where, there used to be all these sort of other artists and bands, and you would see people and people would come over for dinner.
Right.
That's gone. So it feels like I moved to a different building, but I didn't move. I just was one of the few people who stayed in the building after all the leases ran out, because I had a good relationship with our landlord, and then happened to still be here when the law changed. So,
yeah. Do you have the same landlord now?
A different landlord. Different. Now, yes.
And would they would do like nothing more than kick you out so that they could have another luxury tenant?
I think I'm probably in an ideal world. I would not be the grit inside their real estate oyster.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they've actually been really nice about it. I made them a big mural for their lobby to cheer them up over the fact that they had to buy me along with the building. But on the other hand, they got a discount for buying me along with the building. So,
it's not
the end of the world.
When you made the mural for them, are you saying you gave it to them, or you gave it to them at a discount? You
did give it to them. To them. Yes.
So it was really a way of sweetening their take on you dramatically.
Well, it was also actually to say, I lobbied for the loft law a long time ago. I know a lot of situations where landlords have very actively tried to get tenants out, and I know a lot of people who have issues like that right now. And so, you know what, when you have a landlord who is halfway decent, you say, that's great.
Yeah, that
and also,
is great.
I had to walk through the lobby every day. So I thought, this is sort of a preemptive strike. I thought, I'm never moving, so I might as well have a very large piece of art that I like to walk past every day.
So you have a lobby then for this loft building, and what floor are you on?
I'm on the fourth floor.
Nice. Of how many floors?
There are five on one side and four on the other.
Okay. And as you alluded to, you don't really know your neighbors, but do you have any sense of what kind of tenants they are? I mean, just professionals, and that's about all you can imagine?
They seem sort of youngish professionals. The apartments aren't that large, so it's generally not people with children. And they're pretty keep to themselves, pretty much.
So your place is the only big one? What's the difference?
I think mine is definitely the largest loft in the building. Then the artists Blaine de Saint Croix and Diana Spungen, who live next to me, also have a larger loft.
And then the other ones are like lofts that were split?
There's a musician underneath who also has got covered by the loft floor.
So the other units, are those lofts that were split, or they're just smaller lofts?
They gutted the building, so they just rebuilt the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so they just built a whole bunch of apartments into what had been very large, undivided spaces.
Right. There was a brewery on, I think, 11th and Wythe. Is that that's still there?
That's still there.
Wow.
In fact,
Survivor.
Part of my building, my building is like half the city block. Part of my building is their warehouse, in fact.
Okay. Well, that's pretty impressive that they've stuck around.
I think they have a built-in clientele, you know.
Yeah, right. There's one other thing that I wanted to ask you that came up in my head as you were describing the people who had been pushed out, the Poles to the north and Hispanics to the south. Is the Hasidic community that was in very far, far south Williamsburg, is that still there at all?
Yes. Yeah. And they also own a lot of the buildings here. So they invested very heavily in the community. So they own. So they are all there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That community is not moving anywhere.
Right. And they own quite a bit of it, from what you talk about.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
I mean, that's my understanding.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, guess what? Good news, Ellen. We're gonna leave Williamsburg for the time being. So
I mean, it's a fascinating topic.
It is. But you know, but I bet you've probably talked yourself out of it in other conversations. So I think we'd be remiss if we didn't, as we did in our first conversation, revisit your British accent, which. Listeners might wonder, how did you come from the UK 20 years ago when you moved to Williamsburg? And the answer, of course, is no. So you want to just give us a quick overview of where you come from and whatnot?
Sure. This is the whole reason I moved to New York, and I stayed there, was because it was so great that people still asked me where I was from, which was so relaxing. But you're right. There's a reason I can't pronounce my R's, and it's that I was born in England. My father's English. My mother's German. I grew up mainly in England and Germany. My father was working for a chemical company, and so we moved around a lot. And then when I was 14... we moved to Wisconsin. So then I finished high school in Milwaukee, and then have been in the States off and on ever since. But I think I was just slightly too old to lose my accent when I moved. And then I'm also, I think, in my mind for a long time thought I was moving back to the UK. So I kept on making these half-hearted attempts to move back to the UK generally, coupled with various disastrous romances that didn't work out,
when you say you've lived in the UK off and on, are those the times that you were in the UK for those romances?
Romance was generally involved in a lot of my moving around as a young person.
Right. Okay. Yeah. you are very smoothly discreet, aren't you? I can already tell. And when you were in Wisconsin, you were in Milwaukee, was that most of the time, if not all the time, when you were in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. How were your fellow friends, classmates about your accent? Did they give you a hard time? Were they charmed by it?
I don't think anyone was particularly charmed by me as a teenager. I was a sort of particularly sullen specimen of teenager.
Okay.
And also, I think, I was a kind of confused teenager. Like I've been coming from the UK, where it was sort of the end of punk and the beginning and like the new romantics. And so, And I was coming from an all-girls school, and then suddenly I arrived, and it was like the preppy handbook time. I was so confused. So stylistically, I was a massive failure. But there were boys at my new school, at the school I went to, so that was exciting. Mm-hmm. So the public high school I went to had boys, and I realized I really like boys. So that was a massive plus. So all these sort of geeky boys were my friends.
Okay, that's nice.
I was kind of a failure as a Midwestern girl, but I was a raging success as a kind of geeky Midwestern boy,
right.
I would say.
Right, okay. And just one more thing about your accent, because we did talk about it when we spoke before, and that is that you suggested that you kind of tried to get rid of it, but it wouldn't quite take. And I would propose that I think it's been helpful in perhaps very subtle and even maybe invisible ways, but it's been helpful to hold on to. In the States, I don't know. I'd be curious to know if you have any idea from the time that you were in the UK, if it's the reverse. I don't think it is that when Americans are in the UK, that Brits are charmed by that. But, you know, we in the States generally tend to be, I'd say. I mean, certainly in big cities, you know, we're more indifferent to it than ever before. But, you know, certainly in the past, there have been times where people are charmed by this exotic accent. It was exotic at one point.
It was maybe exotic at one point. And of course, I am trying very hard to be charming as we speak. And I'm using everything at my fingertips to make it so. But no, I think that there are good things and bad things about an English accent. I mean, there's on the one hand, yes, it seems to have some kind of cachet. People sort of mistakenly think that you might be intelligent, I think, in the States. But in England, it's much more complicated because you open your mouth and you're, as you know, Shaw famously said, no Englishman can open his mouth without making another Englishman despise him. Because accent means so much. It has this whole class-based meaning.
Right, right.
In a way that I don't think will ever make sense to an American, because it's like having another sense about a person.
Sure.
I think it would be, not comparable, but like the same way that you have... you know, people make assumptions about gender, and it's just pervasive. You just make these assumptions. You just can't imagine not having that piece of information.
Yeah.
Like in England, you can't imagine not having that piece of information about a person that you get from the way they speak.
Mm.
And so it's quite relaxing to be in the States and have it not matter at all and not mean anything. And I think that's one of the great things about going to the UK with an American accent, is that it doesn't mean anything. It just means that you're an American. It doesn't
right.
mean anything more exciting, really, than that. So, you know, people can't really tell much about you. It's like you have a disguise.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, no, I did try to get rid of it at one point because I just thought this is a sort of weird historical relic. I've decided my life is going to be here. And I should just have an American accent, even though it will surprise everyone who knows me. But I can't pronounce my R's, so it just wasn't, it just sounded like I was lisping the whole time. It was a complete disaster. And it was also really difficult to do. And at some point, I just thought, well, I'm just going to just let it all naturally evolve wherever it evolves. And that's
healthy.
You know.
Yeah.
That's where it ended up.
So the U.S. at least gave you the freedom to let it evolve, as opposed to being self-conscious were you to stay in the UK and
let's be frank, I mean, we all have so many things to be self-conscious about, like the last
the last thing you need is another thing
list.
Right,
add it to the list.
Yeah right. So I understand that public art is one of the big aspects of the work that you do, and it's about apparently about 20%, and you can correct me if that's wrong, but I wanted to ask you about the reason you ended up doing public art, because apparently that was the New York Beautification Project.
I was pretty much like a pretty much a traditional painter. I was just painting things in my studio and worrying if they were good or important or relevant or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then got asked, I guess it was in 1998, to be in this show in this park in called Highbridge Park in the upper part of Manhattan. And it was this very dangerous park, and they'd find like a torso in a bag. It was where people went to strip cars and basically have sex. And and they decided they needed to get people into this park. The New York Restoration Project had restored the park. And so rather misguidedly, they thought they would do a public art thing. And I got invited because I knew someone. And of course, you know, it was a complete failure because the only people who came to this rather dangerous park for the opening were the artists and their friends, most of whom probably never went back again.
Right.
But at the time, there was always graffiti in the park. And so I thought, well, I'll make some graffiti too. And it was the time where Giuliani was really cracking down on graffiti artists. And so I made this little Claude Lorrain oval kind of aspirational oil painting over this guy ARD's tag. And I was doing it, I mean, which was kind of intense because there were people, you know, having it off in the bushes for most of the time I was painting.
Wow.
And sometimes for really long amounts of time, you know, just like, you're like, is it easy by himself? Is he with someone? I can hear a lot of action.
Right.
While I did the piece, I just started thinking more and more about it. And I thought about the fact that all these people were being arrested, and part of me thought, you know, it's just paint, right? It's just paint. Like, I am a painter. I could do this too. But what if I did it all wrong? You know, and I am the wrong person. Like, I was like, what happens if you change the demographic? Like, what if you have, you know, a white woman in her early 30s, and which I correctly thought was probably like an ideal demographic for becoming a public criminal. What if, you know, you make these things that look like little, somewhat kitsch landscapes, you know, like, what if you change all, and you're using oil paints instead of spray paint? Like, does it change? Does it become less illegal, like less illegal or less bad if you change those things? Like, how much of that sort of perception of badness is actually, you know, about other things? And so, and then I thought I would just, you know, start making them. And I spent, you know, it took me about, almost 2 years I worked on the project. And it was amazing because I had all these incredible, intense conversations with people on the streets of New York about art.
How many hours a week were you going there?
Well, it sort of depended because I had to find sites. So you had to find a site where you could paint in broad daylight because I couldn't really paint at night. And then you had to prepare, you had to sand the site and gesso the site. And then, because it's a real oil painting, and then you had to paint it. So each site is probably about 4 days. And then I did 40 of them.
So how big are we talking?
They're small. They're like 5x7. They were tiny.
Oh, okay. I was picturing mural size.
Tiny,
okay.
Miniature paintings.
Right.
Yeah, that was the sort of other joke, was that, you know, as one guy told me in the Bronx, he was just like, man, you're never going to get anywhere like this. He's like, you can't even see them from a car.
Right. I'm sorry, and just because I'm not clear, is that 5x7 inches or 5x7
feet?
Yeah,
5x7 inches.
Wow.
And they were really small.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the other thing. I was trying to do the opposite of graffiti in every way.
Right.
So I was trying to see what would happen if you did that. Like, what kind of response would it get?
So how did you go from volunteering your own work and time in you know, these public mini murals or micro murals to actually getting paid to do public art commissions?
Well, because I spent all this time on the streets and chatting with people where, you know, people had all these different stories about public art experiences that they had, and, you know, these sort of crazy people who would like try and kidnap me to go and paint their vans or whatever. I just started to think, you know, I was worrying so much about what I should be doing as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, it's kind of relaxing when someone just tells you what they want. and in fact, maybe I should just do more things that involve that.
Right.
And And I also started to think more about the public space. And so it started with the subway, because I was in the subway a lot, and there was all this scratchiti at the time. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if instead of like, the scratchiti could just be more interesting?
Yeah.
You know, like they should just hire someone to cover all of these, you know, windows with engraved snowflakes so that when you go through the tunnel, it would look, they would glitter and it would be beautiful.
Mm.
And everyone would be so much happier.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I actually called up MTA Arts for Transit to tell them of my brilliant idea.
Wow. Yeah.
Which was, of course, immediately shot down.
Right.
Because they said anything that, you know, we are trying to prevent scratchiti.
Sure.
Encourage scratchiti.
Right.
But I think they mentioned then you could apply to do mosaics or things in the subway. So I applied. And to my amazement, got asked to submit a proposal, and I submitted a proposal which was sort of designed for claustrophobics in the subway. So it was called Look Up, Not Down, so you could see what was above ground and you could orient yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made it. It was, and then once you have one, you just sort of, people ask you to do other ones, assuming that it wasn't, you know, a kind of complete disaster. And I love that aspect of what I do. It's like, I love the fact that, you know, some things I make in galleries and will be bought by people, but then there are other things that are just going to be out in the world. And why should it just be rich people who have lovely things? Why shouldn't they be lovely and interesting things for everyone else?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so fun to think of, you know, what's the best thing? What would be the knife through the heart solution to this rather dreary space of often?
Right. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's a great point, that public art is a way for the world to experience art as opposed to just the 0.1%. That said, the way that you're describing your evolution from, you know, studio artists to studio artists and public artists sounds so easy. is that how you look back on it? You know, one day I started making these mini murals, and then I called the MTA and I got this commission, and then, you know, it just kind of took off from there. Is that pretty much what you remember it like?
Well, there wasn't exactly a master plan, and there was a lot of like, I don't know, some dubious financial times in there. So, I mean, but at the same time, I do feel actually like I was incredibly lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did have this genuine passion for doing things in public. And I also just felt that there was a way in which I was really interested in who gets to make things in public and how
yeah.
do you get there and you know, how do you decide and what's your responsibility, you know, if you're doing something in public. So I did have this real passion for it. And I think in some ways I really was somebody who just, I just tended to just always, I don't know. I mean, the same way I tend to say the first thing I think. I tend to sort of have an idea and see if I can make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it doesn't happen. But
mm-hmm.
every now and then it does. And
mm-hmm.
then, you know, I'm a happy clam. You know,
it's
great.
Yeah.
Great when it works.
Right.
Because so often it doesn't. So.
But when you're making work for the galleries, which my sense is that you do quite a bit of, is it similar process, or are you a little bit more in, you know, I need to have a plan, or I need to sort of follow up on my last show by doing, you know, the next step in that evolution and that kind of thing?
I wish I had a plan. If only I had a plan, my life would be so much better. Everything would be so much more coherent. No, there's no plan. I'm a very obsessive person, so I become obsessed with something.
Right.
Like I all this public art made me start becoming totally obsessed with ornament and like why ornament has been displaced by advertising in our public spaces. Like, why don't we have ornament? Why do we have just stuff that wants us to buy things? Is that all we are? We're just consumers? Like, don't we have a right just for things, crazy things just for their own sake?
Yeah.
So then I became interested in that. And then I'm making a show about ornaments now. But I'm also really kind of weirdly obsessed with nostalgia and the relationship of art to nostalgia. So the other show I'm working on now is about that. And then I'm also fascinated by all this sort of environmental degradation. So the piece I'm making for the Miami Beach Convention Center is all about Florida and its relationship to the water table. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm somebody who sort of is, as you can probably tell, slightly prone to enthusiasms. And then I just run off and do them. And as a result, I do a tremendous amount of different things because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's admirable, and it's great. I for lack of a better explanation, that you can do that because it so goes against the branding style of art making that is the market demands the most.
I'm sort of a branding disaster. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say.
Uh huh. Yeah. But not a financial or artistic failure at the same time, because you've been able to work with that, the multiple avenues, despite not having a branding platform.
Yeah, I think it could be, I could imagine a very different career for myself if I had been a more consistent person. But at the same time, there wouldn't be any point to it then. Like, why would I be doing it? Great pleasure of making art is about trying to think, like, what should I do? If you're ever lucky enough to have any kind of opportunity to express yourself in this world, like, that's so amazing. Like, what should you do with it? It's worth taking that seriously. If I wanted to just do the same thing over and over again, I would be doing something else.
Yeah. Well, but that said, you are in New York, you see shows. How many shows do you see where somebody is not doing something over and over again? You know, I mean, it's got to be, less than 25%, right?
But I think it's also probably part of your personality. Like, I have friends who really are, that person who just has this thing that they're mining, and they just keep on mining it, and that they love it, and they just get better and better at it. And I'm just, I just have a short attention span. So I tend mm-hmm. to be like, wow, I should work on this. And then I circle back to things all the time. But I'm always working on about, six different things at the same time.
Right.
And so I think it's just a personality thing. It definitely doesn't make any kind of, market sense.
Yeah.
It's kind of a market disaster, it's fair to say. But, it could be worse.
Well, but you have various galleries that you're showing in and are selling your work. So, it's not that much of a disaster.
Yeah, no, it's not. But I think there's no question that you pay some kind of market price for not being
a brand.
A brand. Yeah.
Yeah, right. This piece that you mentioned that you're working on for the Miami Convention Center, right? This 1,000-square-foot painting called Atlantis. Is that that's the one?
Yeah,
right?
it's for the Miami Beach Convention Center where they do Miami Basel. So,
so you're going to get a ton of eyeballs on that thing.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Is it?
I'm terrified. Yeah.
What are you
afraid of?
Of
course. What if it's going to be rubbish? Like, I can't tell. Like, it could be terrible. Maybe everyone. maybe I'm totally deluding myself. Maybe the moments when I look at it and think, it's okay. It's not too bad. Maybe I'm totally deluding myself. Maybe it's awful. Who knows?
When is it going to be done? When is it going to be done?
Oh, don't make me cry.
Sorry.
It's meant to be installed in August of 2018.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
I'm making the painting, and then the painting is going to be photographed and made in glass for the convention center, leaving me with a 1,000-square-foot painting with no destination.
Right, right.
But I have that sort of like, if they build it, or if I build it, they will come. I'm quoting things that I don't even know. But I have this sort of faith that I'm going to figure out something to do with my 1,000-square-foot painting when it's done. I'm probably going to make it be really colorful because the glass is going to be black and white. And then I kind of want to use it to try and raise some awareness for the Everglades and maybe raise some money for the Everglades and see what I can do with it.
That sounds nice.
Maybe have, Well, it'd be nice to have it have like a life outside of the convention center.
Yeah.
And also, it has taken up a year of my life. So, God damn it.
So details. How about what are the dimensions?
It's 100 by 10 feet.
10 by 100, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, got it. That was going to be my first guess, but I thought, no, it couldn't be that obvious.
It is that obvious.
It is that obvious. And so has it been restricted you then to just working on that piece, or have you been able to work on others because you've had to,
Well, I was working mainly on that, and then I have these two, I have a show up at, that's opening at the Nazi Quarry in... 2-3 weeks, and then another show at the Children's Museum of the Arts in December. So I have to also work on those in tandem. So
right.
You're catching me at a very underslept point of my year.
Yeah.
So.
And you are working with quite a few assistants on the Atlantis project, right? The painting. Is that right?
For that project, there's no way I could paint the whole thing by myself. I guess I could if I had about 4 years, but
right.
But so I have people doing the underdrawing and the underpainting, and then what you see, the last layer is what I'm painting.
Mm-hmm.
So that everything you see has been painted by me, but all the stuff that goes underneath it to get to that point. Has been a source of income for many young artists this summer.
Yeah. Well, good for you for being a an employer of sorts.
Well, it's actually been really fun. I don't normally have that many people helping me. So that part has actually been kind of awesome.
And how did you select them?
Totally randomly. I just asked my existing studio assistant to invite all her friends, and then they invited their friends. And basically then for about the last 4 months, it's all been, my friends could use some money.
Right.
I'm like, can they paint straight lines?
So do you have several, like dozens of people kind of cycling through, or do you have just a core group, or
There's sort of a core group, and then there are sort of people who come in and out sometimes.
So you might have as many as 10 people in one sitting?
No. I think the most you have is like 4.
Okay.
And then sometimes, you know, on any one day, because it's not a primary job for anyone. So
sure.
People are coming in, you know, they're other artists who have other jobs, but who are like, yay, like a side job, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very chill. It's kind of on the honor system. You come in, you write down your hours.
Well, okay. And you could be completely invisible to them for a whole session.
Sometimes because I have a studio 2 blocks from my home studio that I rented for this project.
Oh,
because
okay.
This project meant that I had the money to rent another studio. So because it's so big, there's no way it could be in my, it would take up my entire home. So,
sure.
And I've done that before. I did an 800 square foot painting, which took over our entire loft, and it caused a little bit of marital friction. So,
interesting.
Well,
like,
you couldn't really walk anywhere.
I see. Yeah, because you had all the paints all scattered all over your living space.
Well, if you think about, you know, an 80 by 10 foot painting in sections, it takes up quite a lot of space. So,
yeah, sure.
And then you're living in the middle of it, and yeah, it just wasn't. It was a solution, but it wasn't one that everyone else enjoyed so much. So,
how many sections is it? 10 each? Is it? Are they 10 by 10 sections or?
No. It's 60 panels.
Oh wow, 60 panels.
Yeah.
So each panel then is quite narrow.
Each panel is 40 by 60.
Oh okay, I see.
Yeah.
So here's a logical, hopefully logical question about painting this 1,000 square foot painting to be photographed and turned into glass, right? That's the final object is. What's the benefit of doing that versus making a digital mock-up and then turning it into glass?
This is a question that has been going through my mind perpetually all summer.
I imagine, yeah, with the space that you're renting, yeah.
But I think the reason I wanted to do a handmade painting of this sort of satellite view diagonally from the Everglades to Miami Beach is that part of it is, when you look at it, it is incredibly impressive as a satellite view. It's very beautiful. Mm. But at the same time, I wanted something... Everyone has seen satellite views. You've
sure.
seen them. And there's something about a handmade object
yeah.
that really tugs at people's heartstrings in a different way. And even though this will be seen, obviously, by a very large art audience, it'll also be seen by a very large non-art audience.
Right.
And I sort of wanted something that was kind of about the romance of trying to see something that's too complicated, really, for the human eye.
Mm.
So I wanted it to be handmade. A lot of pieces I do are insanely labor-intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I like that is, I mean, not on a physical level. Sometimes I tire of my own decisions. But I like it because it's a way of sucking people in. Like, people are attracted by that kind of level of craziness.
Yeah.
There's something about
that.
I mean, it's like, you know... If you see something and it's clear that someone has spent a year making it, you tend to give it a little more time than you do something that was just, you know, you're like, I bought the satellite images, I stitched them together, I printed it, done.
Yeah.
That tends not to grab people's emotions quite the same way.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, it's a cheap trick, but it's a good trick.
Well, I'm glad you used that term, because one of the big questions that arises as you're describing that is, which is it's a fair point that people, especially I think people who will be a non-art audience coming to the convention center, will be drawn in for some of those reasons. But then, as an artist and an art viewer, your professional art viewer, I wonder if you have wondered about this fine line between the impressiveness of labor intensity or the depth of labor and intention with novelty, you know, where that line is and if you worry about crossing it.
Well, I think you always worry. I mean, I kind of worry a little bit more that the whole thing is going to look too kitsch, you know. I mean, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not done yet, so,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
But it's hard not, you know, you both want this sort of romance and this sort of, that very human thing of a human being trying to grapple with something that's too large and too complicated.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of the important thing for me is this, and the piece is very much, I mean, it's the reason that it's going to be made on this handmade mirror. So it looks like the whole thing is a drawing in white floating on this dark mirror, on this sort of sheet of water,
mm-hmm.
which is what, you know, obviously is pretty much the situation of Florida. And so I wanted it to be very seductive. So it's something that's very beautiful, but then it's also kind of, there's something also a little crazy and menacing about it.
Mm.
And it is very much about this human drawing on the landscape. So half of it is the Everglades, and the other half is, you know, Miami to Miami Beach. So it's these two completely different sort of systems of managing water, of living on this land. And one of them is all about this sort of human hand on the land, and the other one is about this sort of natural, like nature's version of organizing
mm-hmm.
water flows and organizing the land. So I wanted it to be about this sort of human writing on the surface of the land. So it made sense to have it be handmade, in a sense, rather
sure.
than machine-made. Which,
sure, sure.
Yeah, for me, but I don't know. There are moments when I have thought, I bet I could have just digitally manipulated this thing so it looked like I drew it.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, as you're describing it, I can envision it to some extent, but then obviously there's so much that I can envision without having seen a prototype. I saw the drawing sort of phase that you had sent me. But it reminds, there are a couple of recent popular examples, which you may be familiar with, that come to mind by perhaps comparison. One of them is this big Detroit art competition, you know, that's open to the public, just was awarded a week or so ago.
Oh, you mean Art Prize?
Yeah, Art Prize. Yeah, thank you.
It's in, isn't it in Crystal Rapids?
Oh, I thought, for some reason, I thought that was, in sorry, it's in Michigan. Is that what?
It's in Michigan, yeah. Because I had a friend who was in it when I went once. And
oh, okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Like,
thank you for correcting me. Yeah. So it was in Michigan.
Sorry.
And no, it's fine. And one of the popular winner is this artist, this guy who did Lincoln, a 10x8 or 12x8, 12x8 foot portrait of Lincoln made from pennies. So they're shiny pennies, they're dark pennies. He used silver pennies for like the shirt or something like that. And obviously that's the kind of project that a non-art audience can appreciate. They can appreciate the labor, you know, the novelty and so on. The other recent example.
And it's Lincoln. I mean, who doesn't love Lincoln, right?
Yes, and it's Lincoln, who could use a little more exposure. And
I've never heard of him. Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
I knew he was a Republican.
Sorry. Right, exactly. And then the other thing, which I have not seen actually, but I've heard a couple of different conversations about, is this Van Gogh film, where hundreds of artists were part of the production process to basically recreate thousands of Van Gogh paintings to make up a stop-motion film. You've heard about this, I assume.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, too. So I mean, those are examples of novelty, obsession, you know, and so on. And I feel like as you describe your mural project, it feels quite different, actually.
Well, I think to me, there's a reason why it's being made by hand, and that you know, certainly part of it is that sort of the way in which it is kind of a cheap trick. I mean, it is a way of getting attention to something, but I want it to be about this sort of, yeah, like I said, this human writing on the land. So to have a human writing it, so to speak, makes more sense than to have just to use a photograph.
Sure.
I would be a much richer person and have a lot more free time if I had chosen to do it differently. But I just, you know, and I tried to persuade myself that it would be just as good. And part of me just felt like that wasn't true. I felt that it needed this element of strangeness, of failure, of your inability to actually describe what was going on. It needed that to have that kind of, I don't know, that sort of emotional heft, which is what I feel it's a serious issue and it's a serious human drama, and part of me wanted to give it that kind of treatment. So, yeah, I mean, there are conceptual reasons and practical reasons. And practically, it made no sense at all to do it the way I've done it. Absolutely.
Well, but wait a second. Would the commission, I don't know if it's a commission or the city of Miami or what, but would they have even been interested if you had proposed a photograph, a photographic mural? Of course, it was the handmade that got you selected in the first place, wasn't it?
I don't know if it really was, actually.
Okay.
I don't think I really stressed how I was going to make it when I proposed it.
Oh, interesting. They had a lot of faith in you.
I could have just made it slightly. I mean, they had a competition with and they ended up, you know, picking six artists And projects do tend to change a bit between the moment they're selected and the moment they're when they're made. So
right.
I don't think that I stressed the handmade part of it particularly. It was much more about the idea of people being in a convention center where you're really divorced, in a sense, from your surroundings,
right,
and you fly in, you fly out, you don't know where you are. And I really wanted to make a case for saying, well, look, you know, this is where you are.
Right.
This, you are part of this larger ecosystem. This is, you know, you are part of this. And then, you know, the great drama of Miami Beach is water, is what's happening with the water table.
Yeah.
So I felt that there should be an artwork that made you think about it. And not in a, you know, particularly didactic way, because I just want people to think.
What was the genesis for the Miami idea?
Well, I knew they were having a competition for it, and
Oh, okay. That's the genesis.
Yeah, so then I came up with the idea for the competition.
I see. Right.
There was a competition.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
entered
yeah.
it. And,
yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And your name, I imagine, going back to the time that we described you sort of stumbling upon public art through this micromural thing that you did to this Miami project, your name has become well-traveled in public art circles, I would imagine. So you were on the radar of the committee, I would imagine.
Well, I think like anything, you know, it makes a difference if you've done something
sure.
before.
Sure.
Yeah. Because people are obviously entrusting you with money and they want to know that they're actually going to have an art piece at the end
So you mentioned that you earlier that you were terrified, you know, about what that it could be a total disaster, which I know is a little bit self-deprecation, but
no, it's actually totally true.
Okay, well, let me ask you this: how big of a sample of this final glass execution do you have, or have you seen, to give you an idea of what it's going to look like?
I've got an 8x12-inch piece.
Right, that's it. That's it.
That's it. That's it.
Wow.
But it's more about what will it look like once it's installed. You know, do you imagine the whole thing? You know,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, there's still a lot of aesthetic decisions between now and my completing it that I
sure.
have to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lie awake worrying more about those. I'm like, am I making, is this looking too cute? Should I change it?
Yeah.
Should it be simpler? Should it be more complicated? Why have I made it so complicated? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Isn't that the essence of the sort of quintessential artist life and, you know, the all the interest and obsessions that you described earlier, you know, that you get to lie awake worrying about these problems of this piece as opposed to problems, you know, regular problems?
Well,
or do
I
you
mean,
do
everyone
both?
Has lots of regular problems too, but...
But do these
so
supersede
like
the regular
super
problems?
Special and have no regular problems.
Right. No, but do these supersede... I mean, if you're lying awake and this is the first thing you go to, then at least it's pushing out those other problems. From
yes,
your head.
Yes. No, this is, I mean, that is, I don't know. I think my husband once sort of kindly said to me, he said, there's nothing worse than an artist with a project, except an artist without a project.
Your husband
and
is
really
smart.
Felt,
yeah.
He's a smart man.
Yeah.
I really felt like he was onto something. Because it's true. Like if I'm not obsessed about something, then I kind of don't really know what to do with myself. You know, I have to admit that I would rather work than do anything else, that's a great thing to be able to say. It's a little strange from most people's perspective. So I love it, but then I also, you know, I feel terrified. I spend a lot of time worrying about whether what I've done is any good or interesting or worthwhile, or is it the best thing I could have done? Perhaps I should have slept even less. Who knows?
Yeah.
Or maybe I should have slept more. It's hard to tell.
Well, I think your husband and your kid probably have the answer to that question, whether you should sleep more or less, right?
Well, I think there would be a resounding vote for more sleeping. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah.
So as you're talking about working, you know, wanting to work, I was thinking about the period that you very briefly mentioned when you were... there were tough times, you know. I guess it was around the time maybe that you were doing that, the 5x7-inch micro murals, you know, in that rough park way up in Manhattan. And so when was the last time you had a job that wasn't your art?
That's a good question. I think the last time I was, you know, kind of normally employed would have been... maybe 2003 or 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what were you doing?
Well, I had this other thing that I did before I was an artist, so which I find always tedious to talk about because it tends to fascinate people and it requires all these explanations. But I'm because you're lovely, I'll tell you about it.
Tell you what, I'll make you a deal. You can tell me what it is, and I won't ask you about it. How about that? I'll spare you partially.
I'll give you, you can ask, of course you can ask. I'm just teasing. So the job I had before I quit, I was very briefly a lawyer on Wall Street. And so I made it through law school and I went and worked on Wall Street for, I guess, 3 years. And at the end of that, I quit. But I had, because by that point, I had enough money, I figured, to live for a year and just make art. So I was like an art school dropout. I dropped out of art school in Berlin. And basically, once I started working, I mean, actually, once I was in law school, it was pretty clear to me I didn't want to be a lawyer. But half a law degree is just a massive waste of money. So, and I'm a fairly practical person. So I was like, well, and I'm going to get a job. And then once I have some money, I'm going to quit it. So, and then after I quit, after a year, I had obviously ran out of money. And then, you know, I was working as a receptionist for a friend's father. See, the English accent has totally been the key to my success. And, and then my old law firm called up and said, well, you know, would you like to work for us this summer? Because we have this project where you have to sit in a basement in Vienna and nobody wants to go. And I was like, Vienna, sure. So after that, for I think it was 4 years maybe, I worked every summer for my old law firm. And that was just a complete lifesaver because it meant I had this well-paying summer job.
Wow.
And yeah, and I rented out studios in my loft. So that was sort of the solution to the fact that I wasn't making very much money.
That's extraordinary, going from being a lawyer to being a full-time artist. I mean, I can't imagine that there's too many other artists who have that trajectory out there.
You know, I'm still waiting to meet my sort of twin soul out there, but I haven't come across any.
Right.
There are a lot of lawyers who become writers,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But not that many, or at least none that I've met so far. But I'm sure there are some.
Well, that remains to be seen.
A lot of people studied law. Didn't Cézanne study law?
Who?
Or was it Gauguin? Didn't Gauguin study law?
Oh, that sounds right. Sure.
That sounds right to me.
Yeah. So we got to go back to the 19th century to find somebody.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny. I'm reading this book called A Little Life. Is that name, that title ring
no.
a bell at all? Hanya Yanagihara. It was a Man Booker Prize finalist. It's a pretty big deal. Or National Book Award finalist. And in any case,
maybe that's where the name, I've heard the name, I feel.
Yeah,
like, but I
yeah.
haven't read it.
In any case, one of the main character is a young lawyer. And his teacher at one point is describing the types of law students that come through and how the sort of artists, creative types aren't a good fit. And then on the other extreme, the sort of scientists, rationalists aren't a good fit either. It's the people that are kind of in the middle that are actually good fit. So if you happen to have read this back in, you know, the late 90s, if it had existed, you would have said, oh, clearly, you know, as a creative type, I'm probably not going to make a great fit for lawyer.
Well,
but yet you did somehow. I mean, do you have that left brain, right brain kind of duality that you're able to go back and forth between?
You people used to always sort of say, well, how can you do both or have been both? And I used to think, oh, well, you know, being a lawyer has nothing to do with being an artist at all. But then I actually thought about it. And over the years, I've realized, no, I mean, they're all about how people come to some kind of consensus, if you think about it. Like, law is just about how people agree to kind of agree, how they agree to do things. I mean, law is all about, like, what are we allowed to do? You know, what do we think is the right way to do things? And art, in some ways, is also all about a kind of social consensus. Like, how do we decide what makes something art and what isn't?
Yeah.
I mean, those are fascinating questions. And the answer to that is kind of consensus. It's like, you know, there are ways in which we decide that something is art. But we could imagine a society where there wouldn't even be such a category. In fact, there are many societies where that category doesn't exist, certainly not in the way that it does in the West. So, I mean, a lot of pieces I've made have been about this sort of idea of, like, how do you decide what art is? How do you decide what it should be? You know, who should be allowed to break the law on the streets?
uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know? Those are questions that, you know, they're kind of legal questions in a way, as I discovered to my horror once I started, you know, thinking about it. But I think it's all. If you're interested in how people organize themselves and how people experience the world, there's definitely some overlap. On the other hand, you know, legal contracts are their own special form of hell.
Sure. I can imagine. Yeah. And would you consider yourself, I mean, it appears, I'm not super familiar with your work by any stretch, but it appears that a lot of your work is painting / two-dimensional, kind of in that realm. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think most of the stuff I make is two-dimensional. I make some three-dimensional things.
Okay.
I make some things that you can walk into.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But the reason I ask is because as somebody who thinks about art that way and having that perspective, having been a lawyer, and bringing that into art and, you know, questioning what art is, it just, that would imply the type of artist that's more of a conceptual type artist, but you're much more of a object or hands-on or visual artist, you know?
Well, but that comes, I mean, I've always loved painting. Like I was, you know, I've always been a massive lover of painting since I was very, very young. I mean, you know, when I was six, we were living in Germany at the time, and I went to Florence with my mother to look at art for a week. That was my idea of a great time at age six.
Wow.
You know, and we just spent a week. We were in the Uffizi every day. I mean,
wow.
Which, you know, just like living in some, you know, bed and breakfast. And so I was always really obsessed with painting. So I love like the physicality of painting. I like everything about painting.
Right.
So I've always liked handmade things, and I've always been kind of weirdly obsessed with handmade things. And I, you know, I'm kind of very conceptually motivated, but I'm very kind of, I don't know, it sort of expresses itself in a somewhat sort of weirdly crafty way where
sure.
I'm always making stuff.
Right.
But the making stuff is the fun part. So like thinking about it is fun, but making it is really fun.
Sure.
And I often think that the two can go hand in hand in a kind of interesting way. But
you know, but that description of your obsession or that, you know, passion so early, how was it again that you ended up dropping out of art school and going to law school? Where's the disconnect? Explain that to me.
Well, it's just like that classic thing. Like my family moved to the States. Like I didn't know anyone. I never met anyone who was an artist. We didn't move in those kinds of circles. And I couldn't really imagine how I could support myself as an artist. So I couldn't really imagine how it would work. And I thought, well, you know, I'm quite good at arguing, and you know, I'm a speed reader, so I'll probably be fine as a lawyer.
Right.
And I mean, I also applied to all these things to cheer up my poor parents after I graduated from college and was living at home with them. And so then I got into law school, and so you know, I went to law school. Once I was in it, I realized that while I was really interested in like larger questions of like, where does the common law come from? But I really wasn't very interested in being a lawyer. But but it seemed you know, when I was a younger person, I was not financially self-sufficient at that point. I couldn't really imagine how it would all work out.
And what was your parents' take on the concept of you heading in the art direction? If they had it at all.
Well, they knew that I was obsessed with art. So I was constantly going off and like making things. And, you know, I was constantly sort of escaping to go off on various art sort of things. But when I quit my job, it was a dark day in the Harvey household, I think it's fair to say.
Right.
So to this day, my parents will ask me if I think I might go back.
To what? To being a lawyer?
Oh, yeah.
Your parents are asking you that now?
Yes, I think my parents will ask me that.
Will you get them on the phone with me, please? This is insane.
So,
can I, just in case, what are your parents' names?
David and Margaret.
David and Margaret, if you happen to be listening to this, you are crazy. What exactly do you want and expect from your daughter, from your child? You need to go to a therapist, a counselor, and talk to them about what you missed out on in your own lives that you need your daughter to become a lawyer at this point in her life.
I think they were just worried about the sort of viability of my life. So, you know, in that very sweet way that parents worry.
That's actually sounds very Midwestern, even though your parents are from the UK originally, right?
Well, they're still in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So.
Right. So they have completely inhabited that mentality. Yeah. So with all of these projects that you mentioned, like three different projects, I think at least, current projects.
Yeah.
You didn't even mention, which I'm very impressed with, the fact that you have a gallery show coming up in just a couple weeks, right? So is that just like another blip in, you know, on your radar of various projects?
No, I totally mentioned it. But
did?
I suppose, well, it's sort of in passing. It's the show that's all about, it's called Nostalgia.
Oh, the Nostalgia,
and it's all
right.
About this sort of weird, like, poisonous relationship that we have with the past and this sort of idea of art as a dark mirror, and has lots of things about clawed glasses, you know, which are these sort of crazy dark mirrors that people used in the 18th century to look at the landscape. And so it's a whole show about this sort of idea of art as this sort of dark mirror that shows us both the past and the future in this sort of confusing way. Partly just because right now I feel so much of the conversation, the kind of political and larger social conversation, is about this sort of past, future.
Right, right.
And this sort of anxiety about the future.
Sure.
This idealization of a past.
Sure.
And so all the pieces in the show are about that.
What were these glasses, these black mirrors or whatever they were, that people used to look at landscapes? What was that about?
So it's kind of like almost the same way that we use cell phones today. So if you were some sort of fancy, I don't know, person going off to do, some fancy lord going off to Italy to do the grand tour in the 18th century, you would bring along this like little mirror, probably about, you know, no bigger than about 4 by 6 inches. And it was slightly convex. So you see like a big picture in it, and it's black and it's direct, so that the image is directly reflected off the black glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of separates out the planes, and it's very theatrical, and people called them clawed glasses because they thought they made things look like Claude Lorrain paintings. And so when you were gazing at some, you know, sublime landscape in Italy, you would whip out your handy clawed glass. And you'd say, and you'd try to find the perfect, you know, kind of framing view. So it was all about this appreciation of the landscape as an aesthetic experience, as opposed to like, you know, like, oh, well, that's great. Look how many sheep there are. Or,
right.
You know, it's that moment where, you know, mountains stop being just scary and useless and become sublime. So it's about this sort of aestheticization of seeing nature. But it's also a direct out kind of growth of this sort of black scrying mirror, or the kind of mirror that you would look into to tell the future.
Mm-hmm.
So and there's also this massive installation in the middle of it called Arcadia, which is a recreation of Turner's gallery, which he built first when he was like 28 years old, and he kept his whole life, the sort of museum of himself. And so there's a kind of mad recreation of that, with all of the paintings were placed with mirrors showing this panorama of Margate, where he kind of lived in sin and had this alternate life as Admiral Booth. So it's all these pieces that are, and it kind of inserts this sort of shabby Margate town, which is this seaside resort of today, into the aesthetics of Turner's time. So there's a lot of time travel in the show. Everything is sort of about the past inserted into the present, and various kinds of mediating screens. And
how much of this interest was motivated by, as you alluded to earlier, this obsession with the past, this glorious, nostalgic past that has come up so far too often in politics?
I think that's why I was thinking about what I wanted to say in a show, and I thought, you know, I'm really interested in that right now, in this way in which the past and the present seem to be kind of circling each other, like, you know, hungry snakes or something like that. And I'm interested in this idea of where does nostalgia fit in, and what does nostalgia have to do with art, and you know, is art inherently nostalgic? You know, is there a way in which what I'm doing is about that kind of nostalgia? So especially given that, you know, art is kind of a luxury good, so you're making things that kind of fit into a pattern of consumption, and what does that mean? So
yeah, and what is your you mentioned, you were talking about public art earlier, but, you know, that not just rich people should be able to experience art. So what is your relationship with your collector base? What are your feelings about that?
I mean, collectors are people, so some are lovely and some are less lovely. And I'm deeply grateful to people who support me.
Yeah.
Because that's fabulous. I mean, I wouldn't be able to continue working if I didn't have people who bought my work or commissioned my work. So it's interesting when you're pursuing something that's a passion, and then there's obviously, you know, there's a kind of practical side of it too. Some collectors have been, you know, become real friends. They're people who, you know, are sort of motivated by similar interests or similar enthusiasms, and that can be a really wonderful thing. But then, of course, you know, then most of the time, those are things that the gallery does that I don't do.
Right.
So.
Right. Are most of your collectors in New York?
New York, a lot in Belgium. I do a lot of things in Belgium for some reason.
Huh.
I got to destroy a church in Belgium. You know, who gets
wow.
to do that?
And do what after you destroyed it?
Well, I destroyed it. I made it into a ruin. I took the roof off and all of the altars and all the pillars, and then I made a floor for it. So it became this new kind of outdoor space for this village that wasn't using its church anymore.
Wow.
I'd say the opening for that was one of the more nerve-wracking ones, because I just thought, you know, if I've got this totally wrong, you know, there are going to be people throwing tomatoes at me.
Wow. Yeah. So they were
really fun, though. I mean, can you imagine how it's a quite sort of godlike power watching people like lift off steeples just because you've told them to.
Wow. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine that at least part of you suspected that this was a very progressive culture and community if you had gotten the go-ahead in the first place to do this.
Yes, but I also knew that there were some people who were upset about it. Ah. So you don't get to just, you know, it was a very small village with a church. And the old church had been blown up in World War I. They'd rebuilt it in 1920, and now not enough people were going to church. And so it was the focal point of the village. The village didn't really have a public square. So the fact that, you know, they did all these surveys and everyone said they wanted more public space. It was what made me think, well, then the church should become a public space. And it's been great because now they have, you know, they have these sort of teenagers put on these light shows and they have concerts and parties and apparently it's a huge hit.
Bravo.
So well, that's really due to the people in the village because they came up with all the uses for it.
Like,
I just made a place.
Right,
you know,
right.
But they came up with things to do with it, which, you know, they could easily have just been, you know, like, well, we hate it. We're never setting foot in it.
Right. Well, that sounds like an amazing public art project to have in your collection of public art projects.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, and because I am really interested in ruins. I mean, that's sort of the nostalgia show is very much about ruins
right,
as well.
Right,
so
right.
there are a lot of ruined pieces, like, you know, the ruins of Penn Station and things like that.
So, you know, as you were describing that viewing mirror, which I think you called glass, is it, what's the title for it exactly?
It's called, glass is just, just the old word for mirror.
Oh, okay.
Because at the time people would call it a, you know, like Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Right.
So Claude Glass. I mean, I think maybe
Claude
now,
Glass.
maybe,
Yeah. I, as when you were describing it in the very first time, I was thinking of eclipse glasses, you know, for our recent eclipse, and I thought, oh, wouldn't that be interesting to be traveling through the English countryside with eclipse glasses, looking at just trying to look at the landscape.
Well, you're onto something, because I have a piece which are these engraved mirrors that are kind of recreations of iPhones and iPads that have like hand engraved drawings of the eclipse.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yes.
I knew there was a reason that came up in my head. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's actually part of the. That's sort of the contemporary version of that thing. Is our kind of, you know, the phones and that we use to kind of mediate our reality.
Yeah.
And to kind of remember everything. So you're like, your relationship to the past is all about endlessly photographing things.
Right.
And yet, of course, it remains.
So when you finish this project, the next time you go into Midtown Manhattan and you see people staring at their phones, it will be because they're looking at eclipse art instead of their texts.
That would be great.
Wouldn't it?
It would be amazing.
Yeah.
We should all look at more eclipses.
Exactly. Well, Ellen, it's been great talking to you.
It's been a pleasure. And if there's anything else, you know, that comes up, feel free to give me a ring.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Ellen for talking to me. Hope you guys enjoyed that. And if you are in the New York area, whether the city or just outside, and are intrigued to check out Ellen's work in person, she has a show opening less than a week than this releases, October 26th. In Chelsea at Dines Corey Gallery. So if you are in the vicinity and are curious, I highly encourage you to go check it out and even introduce yourself. I'm sure if you tell her you're a listener of this show, she will appreciate the connection. Yeah, so I wanted to tell you more about what's going on with this second podcast in case some of you have not heard me mention this in past episodes. I'm starting a second podcast. It's not an art podcast, but I'll tell you about that in a second. Before I do, I wanted to remind you guys that this is a listener-supported show. There are no advertisements, and that means that I and we, as a team, very much depend on your financial and social support of this show. So there are a couple of ways you can do that. First, let me say that I appreciate just about nothing more doing this podcast than getting, of course, the conversations themselves, but in addition to that, getting those email notifications in the notifications or special section of the Gmail account saying either you have received a pledge on Patreon or a donation via PayPal. And you can do one of those two things, if not both, if you are so inclined. And if you pledge $3 or more per month via Patreon, I will add you to the mailing list. I will give you bonus episodes. I will give you tons of love and favors, or $25 or more one-time donation via PayPal. So if you are so inclined and can afford to do so, it would be greatly appreciated. You can also support the show non-financially by sharing the word on social media, word of mouth, letting people know that you think it's a great show. You can leave a great review on iTunes and Stitcher and so on, and let people know that you love this show, and that will perhaps bring more people to the show. Of course, you can follow the social media version of us at Artist Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and you can become a fan on Facebook as well. You can also write to the show. I've gotten some letters of note recently, which I have responded to. So feel free to reach out. I will get back to you for sure. Thank you very much in advance for your support. So here's the deal with the new podcast. It's, for the moment, called How I Get By. I think that might be a lasting title. So what is that show about? What is this show about? You probably want to know. It's about how people get by financially across a spectrum. And it's not just about this is how they make a living, this is how they make ends meet. That's an entry point to talk about values, what people feel about what they're doing, even if they're barely getting by, if they've chosen to virtually or literally kind of get off the grid financially, or maybe they're doing something more conventional, but doing it in an interesting way and have interesting feelings about how they're doing so. So this is the gist of it. I can get into more in a moment, but basically it's been a long time going. It was back in November of last year that I did my first recording. So it has been slow. It's been hard to find people. I think more are starting to come a little bit more easily now. And once the show launches, whenever that is, I think more people will come. But the main thing I wanted to tell you is that I've been speaking to a number of producers who I contacted through the Association of Independent Producers talent list, and I've gotten some interesting feedback, and it's making me think a lot harder about the project and how much production that I'm going to need to put into it. So I've been recording, initially I was recording around half-hour conversations, but more recently they've been going about an hour, and I think they need to be cut down to a half hour, possibly even 20-some minutes, just because I think that is the... I think that potentially I've gotten feedback from some people saying that is sort of the magic range for monetizing and for wider reach. So these are things I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about what is the through line between these conversations. And that's tricky. I mean, I think it goes back to what I was trying to describe earlier. It's about how people feel about their sort of financial state. Without putting too much emphasis on their net worth or how much they make a year per se, it's more about, are they happy getting by with little financially? Or maybe they're happy getting by with a lot, even though it's a very different life. But I think I'm leaning more towards the people who are going to be a little bit unconventional. Or maybe they're just doing something that there's their passion that doesn't pay well, and that's kind of what inspired the show in the first place, my and your as an artist getting by in various ways financially and not necessarily making a ton of money. So what is that like for people? How do they feel about it? That is the gist of the thesis. If you would like to weigh in on that, provide feedback, suggest guests, offer to help, what have you, I am very interested to hear from you. So feel free to reach out. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks again to Ellen. I think that's all for now. I hope you are having a good fall. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.